Welcome to Cogitations, a show where each week your host, anthropologist and UC Davis faculty Tarek El-Haik, encounters and talks with fellow thinkers, composers, philosophers, visual artists, filmmakers, and media scholars who cogitate with images, concepts, and forms. These cogitations are more than reflections. They are an expression of a way of life, an antidote to our dimmed access to the infinite, and an invitation to a joyful experience of our finitude. The show takes its name from a concept that has been key in both the philosophical work of the 12th century polymath Averroes and the interplanetary music of composer Sun Ra. Cogitations sound like the enchanting voices, songs, and music of birds of flames that have entered into our dark world. Today, we will be talking on contagion with the anthropologist Frédéric Keck. We will be talking in particular about Frédéric's book, Avian Reservoirs, and I will get to that in a second, but just give me a moment to introduce my guest, whom I'm very pleased to welcome via Zoom from France, from Paris. Frédéric Keck is director of research at the CNRS, France's National Center for Scientific Research, and he's also the director of the Social Anthropology Laboratory. He's held a position as director of programming at the Musée Quai Branly in Paris. Frédéric's research investigates contemporary relations between human and non-human beings as they are mediated by microbes. He's published several articles and books on the subject, and including his most recent Avian Reservoirs, Virus Hunters and Bird Watchers in Chinese Sentinel Posts, published in 2020 by Duke University Press. He's also co-edited and co-authored The Anthropology of Epidemics with Anne Kelly and others. And he's, of course, written books on the work of Lévi-Strauss and on the work of Lévi-Brull, among others. There is also a book on Bergson, which I have not read, and I look forward to reading shortly. So there are a couple of things that I would like to talk with you about, Frédéric. And first of all, welcome to our program. I'm interested in the field of the anthropology of epidemics and the field of the anthropology of pandemics, and perhaps you can help us think about the distinction between these two fields and lines of inquiry. An immediate observation that to me stems from your work, and particularly from reading Avian Reservoirs, is that it seems to me that humans have not yet learned their lessons. Or at least it seems to me that we learn our lessons in the very, very hard way. Dr. Fauci recently, in his arm wrestle with President Trump, said something which really struck me. He says that we do not have this under control. We are struggling to have this under control. This is a conversation that he had with on the PBS News Hours. So every day we wake up and we look at the coronavirus dashboard, and then we get this kind of data image of sorts, right? And it gives us a portrait of the pandemics, right? And we have these three columns, cases signaled in green, for death, those for signal for death are in red, the cases are signaled in green, and then the those of those recovered are signaled in blue. So my very quick question is, could this have been avoided?
Thank you, Tarek, for the kind invitation to your program. I'm very happy to talk about the book that just came out and coincides with the emergence of this new pandemic without provoking it. I would answer your question about the field of the anthropology of epidemics by saying that my work and those of other anthropologists I work with, is trying to make a turn in the anthropology of epidemic from the question of the social construction of epidemics, which has been raised 20 years ago by Rosenberg, for example, to the question of the anticipation of epidemics, since what is new in the last 20 or 30 years is the idea that epidemics can be anticipated by techniques of imagination that are taken seriously by decision makers, such as the scenarios of pandemic coming from China that surprisingly became real with this new coronavirus. And I'm talking about a turn because when you shift from the construction of epidemics to the anticipation of epidemics, then you start to raise the question of the reality of epidemics. And this is a turn that has been taken in anthropology in a very different domain, which is the what is called the ontological turn in anthropology, which is the idea that you need to take seriously the statements of, for example, shamans in Amazonia or Siberia, who say that the narratives the statements that say that animals are revenging against nature by sending invisible beings. And this is very similar to the statements of virologists who say that nature is striking back against the weapons that humanity has built to control nature by sending pathogens. This is very similar. So what do we make of this similarity? That's one of the starting points of my research. And I'm talking about reality because I'm taking seriously the idea that virologists are virus hunters, that they use the techniques of hunters. And I want to contrast that with other groups who deal with epidemics, who are epidemiologists. Epidemiologists are making models of epidemics, and they advise decision makers about what should be done to mitigate the epidemic, because they use indicators of the curve or the peak of the epidemic. Virus hunters are also advising decision makers, but they try to advise them at the very beginning of the epidemic in order to stop the epidemic from happening. And instead of models and indicators, they use concepts such as animal reservoirs, and they use sentinel devices, such as, for example, a P4 laboratory in Wuhan that detects viruses in bats, or unvaccinated chickens in a Hong Kong farm that die when the H5N1 virus enters the farm. So that's why I try to contrast the models and indicators of an epidemiologist, and which is more enshrined in the social construction of epidemic, and the concepts and the sentinel devices of virologists.
Okay, so I think this is taking me into the direction of how you deal with this conceptual apparatus in your work and in avian reservoirs in particular. And we will return to the question of ontology and the question of whether you are approaching these questions as a modern or a non-modern, or whether there is a friction between these two modes of being in the world and these modes of observation and these modes of articulating relationships between humans and non-humans. In your book, which I truly enjoyed reading, it's really beautifully written, and there is also an interesting use of images to which we will return. You make a distinction between preparedness and prevention, okay? Yes. And I think you invite us to think about precaution in a different manner. In fact, if I understand correctly, precaution is a sort of kind of a version of structuralism's intermediary position, or a mix of preparedness and prevention. And I think I like the way you use certain letters to articulate those terms. So this is what you call the PPs, right? Prevention, preparedness. So could you explain to us what you mean by these terms, and how they are also related to other terms and concepts such as sentinel, simulation, storage, which you refer to also as the S's, right? But specifically with respect to the three territories and sites which you studied, and my understanding is that this is a kind of multi-sited research design, right, in the sense that George Marcus at least perhaps understands it. And these three territories or sites are Hong Kong, Singapore, mm-hmm. and Taiwan, right? And the conclusion to your introduction is really interesting, because you use a word which, you know, caught my attention. You say these terms, you know, the P's and the S's combine and interact in a diabolic mode, right? That reflects the subversive potential of avian reservoir. So how diabolic is this? And how are these concepts, you know, playing diabolical tricks on us too?
Well, I borrow the distinction between prevention, precaution, and preparedness, the three P's, to Andy Lakoff and Stephen Collier, based on the work they've done with Paul Rabineau on biosecurity. Basically, what they do is a historical work and a genealogy of preparedness that contrasted with prevention as it has been built in Europe in the last two centuries, arguing that preparedness is a technique to imagine future disasters and mitigate their consequences, by contrast with prevention, which is a technique to calculate risk based on statistics on a territory controlled by a state, basically. And precaution is an intermediary rationality, because it basically maximizes risk to justify the intervention of the state in a situation of emergency. So we are really in a moment of precaution, because of the failure of preparedness, that is the early detection of this coronavirus in bats, and at the moment of transmission to humans, states like China, Italy, France, and major states in the US have decided to lock down their population. This is a precautionary measure. So the argument that Andy Lakoff makes is that preparedness always fails, because you need to be really quick to do preparedness. But preparedness is a very strong imaginary. And to understand the imaginary of preparedness, you need to contrast it with another imaginary or another rationality, which is very strong, which is prevention, which has worked for two centuries in Europe. And it's because we have this imaginary of prevention that we don't understand preparedness, and that we use precaution as an intermediary rationality to just cope with what is going on. Basically, my feeling is that the role of the state is not to impose sovereign measures in situations of emergency. The role of the state was to ensure social security to its population on the territory. And because of neoliberal policies, the role of the state has been restricted to precautionary measures. That's the answer on the three P's. Now, the three S, Sentinel, simulation, and
storage.
Stockpiling, right. I also borrowed to Andy Lakoff and Stephen Collier, although I tend to systematize it a little bit, because I being trained as a French philosopher, I tend to see three terms and kind of systematize them in a kind of Hegelian way, where Andy Lakoff and Stephen Collier makes lists, right, of techniques. But what has struck me is that these three techniques of preparedness that have emerged for Andy and Steve in the US in the 1950s, with the preparing for a nuclear attack in the US, they are like mythology, ritual, and exchange in the language of anthropologists. Sentinels perceive early warning signals of disasters at the level of animals. So sentinels raise the question of the origins of epidemics. That's the question of the myth. Simulations based on worst case scenarios repeat the sequence of action that basically hospital staff has to go through when the pandemic is here, like triage of potentially pandemic patients. So it's really the role of ritual to tame with emotions in situations of emergency by bringing the extraordinary in the ordinary. And then stockpiling is basically storing emergency goods such as masks, vaccine, antivirals, protective equipment in highly secured places controlled by the state or by multinational companies to prepare for the disaster, like a pandemic. And I make a distinction between stockpiling and storage, which doesn't work in France. So it's very interesting that the English has two words where the French has just one, which is stockage. Because stockage is a major problem for anthropologists when they want to deal with the origins of exchange and inequity, unequal exchange. So my argument is that the three P's are a kind of division within the third, sorry, the three S are a division within the third P, which is preparedness. But it doesn't mean that it is a dialectic in a Hegelian mode, because otherwise it would be too systematic and you would say that stockpiling is the ultimate goal of the history of social security, which I don't mean. So my argument is that each of the three S is actually divided by the distinction between the pastoral and the synergetic. And for example, sentinel devices are synergetic, that is, they are techniques of hunting societies.
Forgive me to interrupt you. Could you say a little bit more about synergetic for those, you know, in the audience who are not familiar? First, just how you're spelling it, right? It's with C.
Synergetic means is spelled C-Y-N-E-J-E-T-I-C.
Okay.
And it means from hunters, right? It's the Greek word for hunters.
Thank you.
And it's an argument basically in the literature after Foucault on biopolitics to argue that Michel Foucault has made a genealogy of pastoral power, but he has forgotten the genealogy of synergetic power. So techniques borrowed from hunters. So sentinels is a technique of hunters. And sacrifice, which is what sometimes sentinels do, is a pastoral technique. And so, and it's the same for the division between simulation and scenarios. Hunters simulate animals, but they don't ride scenarios. And it's the same for the difference between storage and stockpiling. Hunters store goods, but they don't stockpile for emergency, and they don't bring inequity in stockpiling. So the argument is that the division between hunters, hunting societies, and pastoral societies divides all the categories that are nicely distinguished, so that we can say this is the diabolic power of the division between hunting societies and pastoral societies, which is transversal to the big three categories that divide themselves into other three categories and that look like a Hegelian dialectic. And I borrow this idea of a diabolic power to Lévi-Strauss in his study on the split representation, where he talks about this power of division that is really for him constitutive of the human mind, and that precisely resists the idea of a teleological dialectic.
People have trained hawks for thousands of years. A hawk must always be tamed from scratch, and the first step is gaining their trust. I want her to take food from my hand. But the strangeness of my presence scares her. She tries to get away, which is hard, because it's the opposite of everything I desire. I concentrate very hard on trying to be invisible, pretending not to be there, an ancient falconer's trick. This new hawk is bewildered. She stares and stares. Seconds slow and tick past. She's not happy with this unfamiliar situation. Her wings are dropped low. She is crouched, ready for flight. But she looks at the food beneath her feet.
It's been a long time since I've done this, but it's amazing. As soon as the world shrinks to just you and the bird, all those kind of old knowledges just come back like it was yesterday. I know it didn't look like it, but she was phenomenally calm. And there's a moment when you take the hood off a fresh bird where this is going to sound very new age, but you kind of feel their spirit. And I'm in love. She's amazing. She's really, really steady. That was way more than I expected. I'm kind of a bit freaked out, actually. I think, you know, crossing fingers, she's going to be a really cool hawk.
So since we have not learned lessons from the recent past, or even the remote past to a certain extent, I am, again, trying to understand how you reoccupy, to use a term that Paul Rabineau uses, a problem space and a conceptual repertoire that is, as you said, deeply, you know, indebted to French sociology and French ethnology and anthropology, right? I mean, you also, with your collaborators, you define epidemics and pandemics as total social facts, right? This is a term that comes from Marcel Mauss. How do you stabilize, or perhaps the whole point is not to stabilize, this series of analogies between virus hunters and then hunter-gatherers? Why reoccupy a space of classical anthropology, what we understand as classical anthropology? And does that enable you to kind of seek out the afterlife of these figures and concepts? Or this is a commitment to Lévi-Strauss, about whom you've written a great deal, and you know, and clearly you are directing the chair of the Laboratory of Social Anthropology in Paris. So how do you deal with these questions of American anthropology, a certain kind of American anthropology, and then French anthropology? And we know that you are very much clear about the kind of work that you're doing. There is an ethnographic empirical dimension to your work, but there's also a philosophical anthropological dimension, right? How do you play with all of these different traditions? I mean, to use a term which I think is appropriate in this situation.
My PhD about Lucien Lévi-Brulle, and that that led me to a dialogue with Claude Lévi-Strauss when he was still alive, was trying to revisit and revitalize this idea that primitive mentality or savage mind, and this is very difficult to talk about in the American context, but let's say that's the thing that they wanted to talk about, Lévi-Strauss and Lévi-Brulle. Primitive mentality or savage mind ignores contradiction. And they have another way to cope with contradiction than the logic of Aristotle, which is precisely dialectic. Mm-hmm. So what is this way to cope with contradiction that we can find precisely in hunter-gatherer societies, which is not the term that Lévi-Brulle used, but that Lévi-Strauss used? And the whole argument between Lévi-Brulle and Lévi-Strauss is to say that precisely they don't ignore logical contradiction, but they try to mitigate them by using all the categories that they have in store. That's the idea of bricolage, right? So it's a use of storage that is kind of conceptual, but kind of technical, and that allows all societies that don't use writing to mitigate contradictions. And so my argument is that virus hunters, when they are faced with the contradictions of basically our contemporary mode of living, they use this technique of hunter-gatherer societies. That is, they try to mitigate the contradiction by precisely introducing an intermediary term, which is the virus or the microbe. So this contradiction, and I started working on food safety crisis. And food safety crisis always bring up the contradiction between two opposite aspects of the animal. The animal as meat or as a commodity, and the animal as pet or as a living being. And the whole discourse about nature revenging itself when it sends pathogens is the idea that the animal that you eat is revenging itself as a living being against the treatment you make of the animal. So I'm interested in the way these contradictions that we all face as consumers when we try to think, oh, but is the food that is the meat that I'm eating safe? Am I not doing a bad treatment to the animal that I'm eating that is so far from me? This contradiction has been faced by hunters society, and biologists solve this contradiction by saying nature sends us pathogens, right? Animals sends us pathogens when we try to control them. And that's how I explained that they use the techniques of sentinels and simulations of and storage, which are borrowed from hunting society. So in that sense, it's not mitigation in the sense of limiting the number of casualties. It's really mitigating in the sense of coping with the contradictions of our pastoral mode of being that distances us from animals.
So I'm collecting these things for a new sculpture called The Classical Mind, which is based on Aristotle's idea of the scala natura, this great chain of being, this notion that all things are arranged by hierarchy from the things that are the least important or have the least amount of soul to the things that have the most importance. The classical mind is this hierarchical sense which places humans on the top of the kingdom of life, and it is an idea that takes shape in the classical world but has repercussions right to today. And this notion of hierarchy, this notion of some things being better than others, this notion of humans on top is one of the most poisonous and pernicious and long-lasting ideas in the history of Western thought, and it's the justification of all sorts of rankings and taxonomies and modes of oppression. So you start at the bottom of the ladder and you work your way up, or in some cases a staircase. So there's a very interesting illustration from the 19th century that depicts this as a staircase with crystals at the bottom and humans on the top. And so that's what I'm doing, is taking these ideas and pouring it into this staircase as a sculptural form. And then you're able to actually enter the staircase, kind of go under the stairs into a small star chamber. You know, it's a little bit like a closet where one is gazing at the universe. Each step has different specimens. So we start with inanimate objects, and then we go to minerals, and then we go to fungi, and then we go to plants. So I'm working on the plants right now. And then we go to the plant-like animals, like corals and things like that. These are some plants that have had a bacterial infection, and this bacteria caused them to morph. So their stems splayed out wide. The piece itself is a kind of catalog about how we, or almost an encyclopedia of how we protect, preserve, and display the natural world.
So this is helpful, and this leads me to think about how the current coronavirus pandemic is in fact almost ushering in a return of the concept of humanity. It seems that everything that we're doing today, all of the efforts that each of us is doing, right? I mean, we are talking a great deal about our civic duty, our sense of obligation and responsibility to flatten the curve, right, as by all means. And certainly these techniques of medication have played a fundamental role. But it seems to me that I often ask myself, who am I doing this for? So am I doing this for the species? Am I doing it for humanity, right? And it's very interesting because the very idea of humanity it seems to be a conceptual, part of our conceptual past. Mm-hmm. Somehow it's coming back, right? Or at least it's mm-hmm. coming back in the kind of mm-hmm. In the kind of journalistic practices and practices of observation and that try to track the spread of this pandemic. So it seems that all of our efforts, conceptual efforts, to think beyond a certain figure of the human, right, or beyond a certain kind of humanism, right, seems to be just hitting a wall of sorts. So this is happening at the very moment where we're all talking about post-human or anthropology beyond the human. So is the coronavirus pandemic reintroducing what Michel Foucault called the blackmail of the Enlightenment, right? Mm-hmm. So this is, Foucault's famous expression when he was referring to the kind of the task of critique when faced with sticky, and difficult binaries, our dualism. So here we have, on the one hand, the obvious kind of critique of anthropocentrism, which we are invited to kind of reinforce. And then on the other hand, we have the notion of the post-human. Is the anthropology of pandemics, as you're understanding, putting pressure on these blackmails, right? And which is something that we should welcome, in my view. And at the same time, this pressure seems to challenge the Latourian observation, right? And this is, something that I would like to talk to you about, that we have never been modern, right? So are you, I'm really curious, and I'm not interested in polemics here. What happens to the concept of modernity when we deal with the analogies that you are working with, right? When you bring in, modes of subsistence that we seem to assign to an older conceptual repertoire. And I don't use the word older here in disparaging terms. I'm just seeing that it is coming back, and it's coming back even more so. And certainly the ontological turn has precipitated those returns. Are we thinking about a new form of causality here? Is that really what is at stake? And then after this, we can, perhaps conclude and talk about the field where I am, more comfortable with, which is the anthropology of art and the anthropology of images. Mm-hmm. But just on this question of the modern.
Yeah, I try to take seriously the idea that virologists or virus hunters take the perspective of animals. Mm-hmm. Through the viruses, they send us as signs of ecological disasters. Mm-hmm. And by that, I describe very simple situations where biologists say, well, imagine I am a bat. How am I going to send a pathogen that will strike Wuhan and then the rest of the world? Imagine I'm a bird and I'm sending a flu virus that will come through Hong Kong and then take a flight. So this is a technique of imagination, but it works. Mm-hmm. Because it is then equipped with techniques of sequencing, techniques of simulation on databases. And in that sense, I argue that biologists don't take the perspective of humans. They have the possibility to exit the stance of humanity or to consider or to intentionalize bats or birds. As Viveros de Castro says, if you take shamans seriously, then humanity is a form that is accessible to animals, right? Because you can take the interiority of animals to have a perspective on humans. And in that sense, I contrast virologists with epidemiologists, because epidemiologists talk for humanity, right? Okay. They are pasteurized in this sense, is that they want to save humanity by, as you say, flattening the curve. And virologists, they don't want to save humanity. They want to save the environment as a whole. Not Gaia. Gaia is too big. But disrupted environments like South China. And I take also very seriously the biological concept of humanity as an epidemiological dead end. This is one of the final sentences of the book, if you remember. Mm-hmm. And I use it as a kind of clin d'œil, or how do you say?
A wink
to Michel Foucault's last sentence of The Order of Things, Les Mots et les Choses. The idea of epidemiological dead ends means that for most pathogens that cross species barriers, humanity is the end. It's very difficult to move, for the coronavirus, for example, it's very difficult to move from humans to dogs or cats or ferrets or birds. But it's easier to move from bats to pangolins and then to humans. So this idea that the humans, probably for ecological reasons, because the humans are a niche that has occupied all other niches. So because humans are so numerous, when you're a coronavirus and you invade a city like Wuhan, there's very little chance to go back to the bats, and you cannot return to you cannot go in, you cannot occupy pets like dogs and cats. So this is the idea of it's not the end of man. Well, it looks like the end of man in the dissolution of man in the forms of languages, but it's the forms of languages in the sense of biological sequences, right? Mm-hmm. Now, this leads me to the question of the modern. I don't mean at all to say that we've never been modern. And I don't want to say that we have to return to hunter-gatherer society, a small protected environment, undisrupted ecosystems, and so on. Even though I'm lucky enough to live in a small village on the border of a forest, my conceptual stance is that there's a shift in modernity from what I call synergetic power, which is the power of hunters, right? Which is challenging the power of the state, which is a pastoral power, which is a mix of pastoral power and sovereign power. And my argument is that with modernity, I agree with Foucault that the advent of modernity is the end of the 18th century in Europe. With the advent of modernity, hunter-gatherer synergetic power turns into what I call with colleagues, particularly in Australia, cryopolitics, which is the idea of conserving forms of the past in, you can say, fridges, and in a metaphoric way, which is also databases, museums, natural reserves, all the spaces where you can preserve and conserve patterns from the past, right? And this leads me to the question of images and art, because my stance is that if you want to understand what virus hunters are doing in Hong Kong when they align with bird watchers to track or map the diversity of viruses among birds, they're doing a work that is very similar to curators in museums when they make inventories of all the things that have been collected by, you can say, hunters in the last two centuries in Western museums.
So I think we should continue this conversation by other means whenever this pandemics is behind us, if it's unimaginable at this point. And it would be nice to have you in UC Davis at some point. So I would like to thank you and for answering my questions and for being with us today.
Thank you, Tarek.
Take care.